When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We're talking about the systematic cutting off of what is possible for healthy development. It's a state-sanctioned institutional cutting off of healthy development in so many different ways. You know, we can start to disentangle, okay, you know, how is sense of community fractured by hypervigilant law enforcement or the lack of accountability? If I know that someone could literally take the life of either me or my child or my parent or a family member or a best friend or simply someone that looks like me, talks like me, acts like me, that they can literally take their life with impunity, then what does that say about me and my place in the world? How can I possibly feel that I belong to these spaces that I'm a part of? And what does that do to my sense of confidence? What does that literally do to the connections that I have available to me if these relationships are being disrupted in this way? And I'm told that it's okay, that you're wrong, you did this wrong.
Therapist Uncensored brings you decades of experience with interpersonal psychotherapy, relational neuroscience, modern attachment, and anything else they think will be helpful in healing humans. Now, here are your co-hosts, Dr. Ann Kelly and Sue Marriott.
Hey, everybody, this is Ann and Sue, and we are back on the air. We are recording at a time of worldwide protests. And the tipping point, of course, was the on-screen callous murder of George Floyd that we all had the burden of witnessing, and it's a burden that is long overdue. And one of the things that we have done in response is that we have closed our mouths. Isn't that right, Ann?
Yeah, we've actually taken our own virtual need and have decided to hold back for a few weeks on producing podcasts because it's actually a time for us to really reflect and listen and absorb.
And learn.
Absolutely.
Right? Instead of us being trying to tell anybody anything, it's with absolute humility as we've really, really been studying and learning and reflecting. And I've been blown away. You know, we talk about light bulbs of insights. This is like, oh, shit moments that blow my mind of things that we embarrassingly haven't been aware of.
Right. And it's absolutely been time right now for, instead of us being the experts, we want to amplify voices and amplify voices that could teach us so much.
So we've been doing that quite a bit on social media, and we will be doing that today as well. But before we get to the podcast today, want to mention there's two of our favorites. One of our favorites is Resma Minicum, who's a Black therapist, and he talks about embodied racism. Fantastic. Again, you've been seeing this already on social media, but if you haven't heard of him, his book is In My Grandmother's Hands. And he really talks about the somatization and the unconscious implicit experience of race that we aren't even aware that we have. And a lot of it is based on the nervous system and fear.
He talks a lot about epigenetics, which I was really happy to see so embedded in his work. And also, we really loved White Fragility.
Robin DiAngelo.
Right.
I liked that one so much that we made that available to our patrons. We're scrambling with what can we do besides be quiet. And one thought was, one, we do our own work on this, which we have been doing. And then also by distributing that particular book, we are encouraging everybody to do the same. So rather than the loud protest or liking things on Facebook, it's more of like, really, and again, this is just for the folks that aren't people of color that are listening, but, you know, looking at our own race and getting comfortable with our own race and what that means, because part of it is there's been this invisibility. We didn't even know we had a race or we disowned it quite a bit. So there's a lot there. Please check the show notes. And then today, as we get back on, we just wanted to say that much because, again, this isn't about our reaction. This is about keeping the focus on the issue at hand. And we've got a really great guest for you today.
Okay, as we jump back in to the episodes for Therapists Uncensored, we're going to start with an interview that we actually planned months ago on the healing power of hip-hop in reducing depression, anxiety, and promoting empowerment. And these two guests, the reason we're starting with this interview is that these two guests, Dr. Raphael Travis and Dr. Elliot Gann, both center their individual and collective work on amplifying voices and healing individual and collective trauma. So this seems really pertinent today. But rather than just jumping into the specific topic, we recorded one long discussion with our guests, but intentionally divided into two parts, and here's why. Raphael Travis really centers his research and writing on Black empowerment, Black youth, and civil engagement. And he's the author of The Healing Power of Hip-Hop, Intersection of Race, Ethnicity, and Culture. So we're going to break from our traditional format, and instead of interviewing, I really just want to hand the mic over to Dr. Travis in the first part and really hear what he has to say and give him the opportunity to just voice his perspective and insights and us be the listeners. So on this episode, you will also hear Dr. Gann join us at the latter part, but he also basically cedes the mic to Raphael Travis to hear his perspective. And then we'll hear much more from both of these individuals, especially Dr. Gann, on our next episode, specifically on the topic of hip-hop. All right, let's jump in. All right, welcome to the show. And as you both know, we're recording during this time of the protest in Minneapolis, and it has spread throughout the country and the world. And Raphael, I'm going to turn to you initially. Your expertise centers on race, culture, ethnicity, and you really have an emphasis on youth empowerment, and civil engagement. So I'm extremely interested to get your perspective. And from what I understand, the primary driver and organizers of this very powerful movement are the youth, right? Like primarily those under the age of 30. So could you shed light on this? Why such a tremendous voice of the youth? And, you know, really, why now?
Yeah, sure. And again, thank you so much for the invitation to be a part of your podcast. In general, I was excited to come on and talk about hip hop integrated strategies for mental health. But I also appreciate your willingness to make room to really shine a spotlight on what's going on and such a significant issue that's like you said, has turned from local to regional to national to global in just a matter of weeks, which is profound in and of itself, along with all of the other things that are going on in 2020, which have turned everyone's lives inside out. But thank you again for the invitation to be a part and to allow, you know, your platform to talk a little bit about what is going on around the world and these protests that have really just captured the spirit and imagination of so many. And the conversation about, or at least highlighting the significant role that young people play, is really a testament to all social movements. If we look back, obviously the one that people tend to correlate this most closely with is the civil rights movement, but that was incredibly occupied by young people. It's that spirit, the energy, the desire for things to be different, the willingness to, you know, lay your life on the line for the things that you believe in and care about. And so I think it very much mirrors what often happens around issues of change is a generational shift. Not saying that it isn't a cross-generational desire for things to be different. But oftentimes you have that youthful energy around, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. Sometimes even to the effect of, you know, you tried it your way, now we'll try it our way. You know, at the same time, there's so many young people, this is very much multi-generational, and I think it's tapping into the fact that these experiences, the discontent, the outrage, the anger, the resentment is something that has been experienced across generations. So the story is the same, but the particulars are different, but it is really tapping into a common desire for things to be better. And I think the empowerment-based positive youth development perspective that I spend a lot of my time kind of analyzing people's lived experience through touches on really a lot of the hallmark components of really what people care about here, you know, in what I try to convey as when we think about what is important for young people to grow and develop in a way that is healthy and not just for the short term, but for the long term, and it affirms identity in one place in the world, is we really pay attention to, you know, how certain things relate to each other. So connection, people's ability to relate to positive, supportive adults that are around them is hugely significant. But it's significant in the sense of what else it reinforces. It helps to reinforce people's confidence about how they show up, what they can do, what they can accomplish. It helps to reinforce the things that the competencies that we know are important, not just school competencies, but life skills and social emotional competencies. And so these are pieces of development. But when you unpack, you know, why are people so upset? If we just look at those aspects of development or have concerns about their relationship with law enforcement, it's because law enforcement are the people that kill and take away people's parents. They literally break that connection at the core with impunity and without concern and a consistent lack of accountability. That's just a tiny little sliver. And so if you fracture that connection, which is the heart of development, you know, you're talking about generational ripple effects just simply from that. And that's just a little piece of it. But through my model, one of the things that I pay a lot of attention to is the role of community and engaged citizenship. So a lot of early scholarship around positive youth development focuses on connection and confidence and competence and caring and character, right? Those are the five C's of positive youth development. But what I really hope to add to that conversation was the recognition that the engaged citizenship or contribution, oftentimes it was talked about as this sort of after effect. Like if you grow yourself to a certain level in a healthy way, then you are more likely to contribute to the environments that you care about. You're more likely to be involved in service and change and things like that. And part of what I wanted to add to that conversation was particularly for young people of color, sense of community and that idea of contribution or engaged citizenship, those are part and parcel with healthy development. And one doesn't have to happen before. There are young people, for example, when I was doing more work in the youth organizing programs and social justice youth development programs, oftentimes young people that kind of were not doing so great and feeling so great about themselves, kind of marginalized, kind of on the outside, they were invited in to say, hey, come work and be a part of this community. Let's work on this community project. You take this role, you know, talk to these people about this issue that's important for our community. And then you saw the opposite happen, right? By being engaged, being a part of something, you know, having that sense of community, all of a sudden they were more confident. All of a sudden they were doing things that they didn't really realize they had the skills to do. You know, advocacy, policy work, outreach to, you know, invite other kids and other adults to be a part of change efforts, right? So you saw the opposite direction. That's empowerment, right? That's what empowerment is. And that's not something that somebody can gift you. That's something that develops. So that's a big part of, you know, kind of the underlying model is how do we invest in opportunities so that people can be empowered? And so when you talk about issues like George Floyd, the reason that it is so significant is we're talking about the systematic cutting off of what is possible for healthy development. It's a state-sanctioned institutional cutting off of healthy development in so many different ways. You know, we can start to disentangle, okay, you know, how is sense of community fractured by hypervigilant law enforcement or the lack of accountability? If I know that someone could literally take the life of either me or my child or my parent or a family member or a best friend or simply someone that looks like me, talks like me, acts like me, that they can literally take their life with impunity, then what does that say about me and my place in the world? How can I possibly feel that I belong to these spaces that I'm a part of? And what does that do to my sense of confidence? What does that literally do to the connections that I have available to me if these relationships are being disrupted in this way? And I'm told that it's okay, that you're wrong, you did this wrong. And so I think taking a step back too is, you know, a lot of what we know is important, you know, we pay attention to the entirety of the life course, right? So thinking about how experiences and things that happen to us at one point, they don't just have an effect for now. They have effects over time. So sometimes that effect may show up later in life. Sometimes it may set us on a different path where maybe I was planning to do this, but this disruption caused me to have to do something else. Or maybe it's a cumulative effect, right? It's a slow build. It just affects so much of our life. You know, there's a conversation about defunding police, and that's the big thing. Wow, how could you possibly defund police? And I think it's, first off, it's one of those kind of misnomers, the idea of, okay, no more police ever. That's not what it is, but it's a more nuanced conversation about how do we distribute resources and what does public safety mean? You know, and so when you think about the criminal justice system and the role of police for young people in their development, obviously the one first place is to look at schools. If we look at what is the role of law enforcement in schools, a great report from ACLU came out that was looking at the distribution of mental health professionals versus law enforcement within schools. And you kind of just kind of look at those ratios. What are mental health professionals? What could they do within educational spaces versus what can law enforcement do in educational spaces? The ratio is off, but then when you break down what police are often brought in to deal with, what are alternative approaches to dealing with those situations, then it gives you a little bit of an idea of what people are talking about when they're talking about defund police. It's not saying don't have any police. It's just saying the roles that we have attributed or given to them could be handled oftentimes by professionals with alternative skill sets. You know, but it, again, that relates back to, you know, what is important for how people grow and develop healthily over time. It's family, it's community, and it's the policies that often contribute to social determinants of health, right? So simply thinking about educational policy, if we just limit it to that, simply thinking about educational policy, what we know is important for young people to get out of their school experience, whether it's academically, socially, emotionally. And we think about how might things be better if we just simply switch the ratio of funds towards mental health professionals. What might that be like? We don't know. That's something that could be studied. We have some examples. We know the difference that it does make on campuses when there are mental health professionals.
And when there's police, like, I love what you're saying, not only about the different roles that can be divided, but we can't move away from what the influence police have in their presence. You know, speaking of the presence of police for some creating a sense of safety, but the awareness right now and for all of us is that's not safety for many Black and brown youth. It's a feeling of alarm. It's a feeling of threat. And that's what I hear you saying. So that influence and how does that impair a child's ability to feel part of the community, as you were saying.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. What does that, you know, that you're that hyper surveillance, what does that mean from a stress response, anxiety response, every little thing? When I worked in a residential treatment center, one of the things that was so clear to me from the earliest days is that if you're set up in a system that is literally watching every step that you take, of course you're going to mess up. It's just not possible, right? It's set up. You're literally under a microscope. That increases your anxiety. That creates your reactionary to the slightest little thing. You're worried and all. Increases
your cortisol, like you were saying. So the cortisol and the stress response, which creates in our body the defensive response and into a lockdown response, not an open, engaged response.
Right. And so we get too deep with the neuroception and what that does, you know, the ability to form an authentic, healthy connection with individuals eroded. But then you think about that long-term cumulative effect. And that's the reality. That is 100% the reality for many communities of color, is that you can leave those hyper-surveilled environments, but that anxiety remains. That stress remains. And it's problematic. It's problematic from just the most innocuous way. It's like, wow, you know, I'd rather be able to walk somewhere and not really be bothered, to the most extreme of, I'm really fearing for my life. I'm fearing for my life, not just for me, but for the people that I care about. And so kind of back to the original question of, you know, what does this mean for young people? I think it's similar to how young people have felt over the generations. So in that way, it's nothing new. And the desire for change is nothing new. But at the same time, I do feel that there are things that have been surprising to me that offer hope and some optimism. You know, I think there's a tremendous amount of diversity that I see in the crowds, and sort of the underlying notion that silence is being complicit. I feel like that little nugget, it may always have been there, but at least from my perspective, it seems like that is more prominent. And it's kind of reverberating a little bit louder than I've seen it in the past.
I agree with you. I can feel it in myself, and I can feel like the experience of silence, or if you're not out there actively speaking, that you're being complicit. It's not enough anymore to just say, yeah, I agree with them. And I can feel it in my own body. I can feel it with my kids, the challenges that my kids give me. So I can experience it in my own home. I have three young adults, they're teenagers. And their ability to bring discomfort to me personally on a daily basis, I will say, right? And I consider myself pretty woke, and but not, right? Like, I have been humbled in a great deal by this, by the challenges of if I'm willing to be out there. It's been difficult with, you know, you mentioned we're in the middle of a pandemic. So there's this place, I'll just be frank about what they shared with me. We're in this place of to go out was to increase the risk of a pandemic. And my kids' response and their friends is, well, to not go is to continue a pandemic. And it was very enlightening. And they were saying, you know, our Black and brown friends don't have the choice but to feel fear every day. And if you stay home because you have fear, that's the discomfort in your body, but you have to take that fear and really think about what people of color have to live every day. And it was super uncomfortable for me in a really pivotal way, because I was like, y'all safety. And, you know, like, I was coming from a mother bear perspective. Right. But it was humbling, and they've insisted about our involvement.
I can't help but think, I mean, I think that analogy that people are making around the pandemic and the pandemic, because people had no choice but to experience the anxiety of the pandemic. There was a universality, and obviously there are significant differences as well, but there is a universality of just a core fear, a physiological fear, you know, around people's own kind of mortality, that I think the proximity allowed people to tap into it in a little bit of a different way than maybe if they had the opportunity to just distract themselves with whatever else they would be doing if there was no pandemic going on.
I think about what you're saying, and that like to personally, again, relate to the fear in my body on a constant basis that I have not had to experience so much in my life, this fear for myself, and to have it perpetually and consistently on this ongoing basis. And I think what I hear you say is getting in touch with that fear and then really hearing the protest and really hearing about the persistent, constant experience of fear and being able to kind of feel that body to body. Obviously, it is a thimble. It's only a moment in time for me in that experience where it's a lifetime and intergenerational time. But it is humbling. It does allow the persistence to continue. And yeah. Elliot, feel free to jump in if you have some thoughts on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just, regarding the change that we've seen and perhaps your understanding of this message that really is spreading via, I think, social media and socially about being complicit. If you're silent, if you're not standing up, I wonder if in part the younger generation understands that due to perhaps some SEL, like socio-emotional learning initiatives, and increased focus in the past 10, 15, 20, 30 years on bullying, and that don't be a bystander or, you know, step in. And because that's part of the language of like the anti-bullying campaigns. And of course, the irony isn't lost on me on like our president or president's wife trying to like be part of an anti-bullying thing is just like the most hypocritical and ironic thing I could ever summon in my mind. But even that, like if they're doing that, it's clearly become a mainstream phenomenon in talking points and development and youth and education and bridging over to mental health. And the second thing is I wonder about the role of social media and the internet and access to counter narratives and non-mainstream voices. But hip hop really has served since its inception to create a counter narrative of marginalized, normally silenced voices to have a narrative and create a counter narrative and create volumes of knowledge. I don't, I'm not phrasing it perhaps correctly, but both kind of verbally and orally stored forms of knowledge and communication, but also then it becomes recorded. Now through social media, the mobilization, rapid both mobilization and sharing of that and ideas spreading where that can counter kind of racist mainstream, you know, stereotypes and narratives that we've heard in the media, in public kind of dialogues and narratives since the inception of our country.
Yeah, I think there is room for both of those. SEL has been something that has been introduced in schools in a lot more of a forthright way over the last, 10 plus years, which is something that was kind of on the margins. And like here in Austin, for example, has one of the most robust SEL initiatives within AISD in the country. And so there is a lot more attention to not just what young people need academically, but socially and emotionally as well. And bullying is obviously enjoyed a lot of attention as well. And then there's the other side is that there are just a lot of people that are doing important youth work just in general and really trying to help young people feel, empowered that they have a place in the world, that, not to just sit by. And so, I'm hoping, as you suggest, that some of those efforts are bearing fruit, when push comes to shove and in the time of immense crisis and forces people to be reflective and decide, am I going to sit on the sidelines or am I going to participate? But again, recognizing that that has been consistent over time. Young people have been doing the work. And
they're always the change agents.
But I think it is exciting. And the latter point about hip hop, that's why we do what we do. And that's one of the biggest things that I love about hip hop culture is that willingness to be self-reflective as well as constantly be time-specific in making social commentaries.
And critical, too.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the formative role of potential of music in general, and that, it's the story that I always tell about, Public Enemy. One of the greatest things for me as a young person was that counter-narrative. Mm-hmm. The counter-narrative of growing up in the 80s of, what it meant to be a young Black male. The larger dominant narrative of the time was, young Black male, super predators. That was Central Park Five and, Wilding and all these things. And so Law and Order prevailed because there was this larger narrative, kind of going back to what we're talking about with George Floyd, that's part of the story, right? How do we perpetuate these disparate ways of treating people based on these artificial narratives that allow biases to persist, that allow stereotypes to persist, that allow people to do things that are inhuman under the name of this false narrative. And so part of the challenge, this idea of not being silent, is simply saying that, yes, this whole story that has allowed us to get to where we are is not true. it's not true. And it's allowing the perpetuation of things that are extraordinarily harmful to a major segment of the population, a major segment of the population that played a tremendous role in building, you know, this nation. So Elliot's points about, you know, the counter narrative and technology allows us to consistently be persistent about pressing the counter narratives in real time, immediately as they happen. Somebody says something that is not right. Boom. It's on Twitter. It's on Facebook. It's on social media. No, let's challenge this. Let's point out where you've been deficient about this. Or let's just pull back the curtain a little bit and provide some context to something that maybe you weren't aware of that you need to pay attention to.
Right. The institutionalization of these things that needed the curtain pulled back, like to be able to see real-time video where instead of reading a report, this black man was aggressive and threatening and the police officer was just there for the safety of the public, and to be able to see real-time videos to counteract that narrative, to see how off and the injustice of it, and to be able to have that in your face. There's no denying it. And the persistence, I think, as you've mentioned before, the persistence of the youth to keep holding the mirror up. And it feels like right now there's such a mirror to our nation.
I think there's an element of truth to that. And there's also, it's pretty amazing that nonetheless, if we have these videos, still the white supremacist narrative persists, even in an interpretation of the videos, where despite everything that we see that would suggest, you know, that this person was killed for no reason or other than, you know, the fear, the paranoia, the training, the socialization of, you know, these police officers or people who are killing, you know, these folks, you can still see the fear-driven and, I would argue, racist narratives and voices interpreting these videos saying, oh, no, that this cop was right in doing that. And you said there's no denying it, but people still employ the racist narratives, the fear-driven narratives in their interpretation and understanding of the media that they see. And you can still see like the defense of denial in operation.
It's such a good point. And I'm so glad that you jumped in on that, because I just stopped to think about just the words that are often uttered out of our top officials' mouth, that it's like, does not everybody hear that? Or do we see it and we see the interpretations and the lens that it goes through? And it still does get interpreted. It's really, you're right, really accurate.
I mean, it's the, you know, the old adage about the storyteller, you know, it depends on who's telling the story. And so I think in a lot of those instances, it's not even about like, is it rational or is it irrational? It's what is the agenda of the storyteller or the person that is narrating it. And so if your agenda is not aligned with, you know, whether it's equity or empathy or fairness or justice or whatever, then you tell the story that fits your agenda. And I think sometimes we get lost in trying to interpret it through the lens of rationality, as opposed to interpreting through the lens of, you know, what's the goal here? What's the objective? Because then morality or rationality, it's not even part of the equation. Right.
It's, you're actually doing it through the lens of the body, aren't you? The lens of, it isn't rationale. It's what's in our body, what we've been in our own culture, you know, led to believe and to hold in our body. A black man is somebody that's scary, or a, you know, that then we see that and we interpret it through that lens, as well as our agenda to hold our own, for lack of a better word, institutionalized control.
Yeah. It's, privilege and power.
To not experience loss.
I guess I still would say, from my perspective, I think there are unconscious and nonverbal narratives as well, right? Per what we were talking about, I think about it from a psychoanalytic, psychodynamic, you know, attachment perspective. All of us do have agendas. We have individual agendas, which are inherently selfish, just as human beings, as we exist, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, and also the altruistic and pro-social ones as well. Perhaps I'm a little more cynical or skeptical as a psychoanalytically informed person, but I think overall, my perspective and Raphael's, like, I find, despite our theoretical, you know, orientation differences or whatever, we have a massive amount of overlap in the way that we see you know, the potential for empowerment in the use of hip hop and just in terms of the lifespan development aspects. And what I really like about Raphael's model is the way that he talks about these upward trajectories in the narratives of hip hop.
Continuing on from what we were talking about, you know, kind of all these things happen, whether it's technology and COVID, the silence is complicit. The diversity of youth is very important. I think diversity among youth, and I can't help but feel like there's a large contingent of young people that felt they couldn't engage, but I think have just been given permission to engage. Mm-hmm. That I feel is very important. But also, I think there is an intergenerational piece that's there that is important, as well as a global piece that's there. And again, like, nothing is new, but I feel like mm-hmm. there's a synergy, there's a confluence of energies that is different. And I think that there are lots of groups that have been marginalized in our society that see themselves in this incident, in this person, whether it's the Latinx community that has been struggling over generations in and of themselves around issues of immigration, but it's become very acute over the last few years with the inhumanity and in the treatment and just the callousness of people's social reality. Again, this idea that, you know, trauma is just a word, and not really understanding the depth and pervasiveness of traumatic experiences in the short term and in the long term. So I think there are large segments of that community. Elliot and I spent some time in Hawaii doing some work around hip hop and youth development. And that was one of the things that had a lasting impact on me from the Native Hawaiian population, just how much community and solidarity there was about, and pride in their cultural history, and just recognition of where their community was marginalized and exploited in terms of, you know, how Hawaii became a part of the United States and what persists to this day through the marginalization. But just to seeing, you know, and they had their own kind of stuff that they were dealing with, but seeing the recognition of the struggle of the Black population here, the Native American population identifying. And this is where it comes back to hip hop. I think hip hop does a good job of giving a voice to communities that feel marginalized wherever they are around the globe. And so, you know, all these places you have young people wanting to express and having their ability to express when things are not great here because of X, Y, and Z, and are able to articulate very specifically and clearly, as Elliot suggested, it kind of builds on this sort of archive. You know, how do we speak? How do we provide counter narratives? How do we speak to the conditions that need to be changed? You know, we have a rich history of that that we can draw from, that these voices are getting energy from. So I just feel like there's just this huge confluence of events that are allowing people to tap into not just that, hey, this was a really messed up situation, and tapping into, hey, this whole thing is a really messed up situation. The way that we've constructed this whole, you know, use the house of cards analogy, right? This is the whole way we've set this up is not right. And there are a lot of people that are suffering because of it. And it's given advantages to some, but it's been enormously exploitive and taken advantage of a lot for those and advantages. So at least if we can just agree that it's set up, then maybe we can move forward and figure out, is there a way to do this a little bit better? And I think historically that has made a lot of people nervous. I feel like a lot less people are nervous. They may not know or have the answers. At least people are willing to say, okay, you're right. You know, somebody tells you something, explain, you're like, okay, you got me, you're right. You know, yes. I feel like we're at that point. Like, okay, yes, this is clear. All right, let's figure something out, you know?
I mean, I've been nodding silently along with everything that Raphael's been saying. And I guess I would just add, and I don't know if I stepped away for a minute and missed you saying this, Raphael, but certainly when you talk about the confluence of multiple events, COVID, you know, a pandemic within a pandemic, right? And the intersection mm-hmm. of this mass threat and invisible enemy, which already, you know, increases our stress response individually. And I would say from a group and larger macro perspective, it has a large scale impact on large group. The large, you know, I'm not super into like Jungian psychoanalysis, but the collective unconscious and large group scale anxiety, paranoia, fear, and threat. Everyone's experiencing elevated stress levels, cortisol, et cetera, in addition, you know, to like whatever other kind of unconscious components of that, which kind of ripple out through our society, et cetera. I think those two things intersecting leads to some kind of compounding or exponential outcome, which perhaps we're seeing. Maybe, you know, this would have happened anyway in terms of like the outcry to, you know, the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all the other folks. But I think that there's also people, there's a lot of cross currents and multiple streams of input here, right? But, you know, mm-hmm. the restrictions imposed upon people physically, emotionally, psychologically through COVID, the fear of the government and other groups controlling us, the whole kind of premise of like the American dream and American ideal of the individual and individual rights and freedoms, the contradictions therein of white people having these freedoms and black people, non-white people not having it. And then maybe some white people kind of starting to experience some of that or being afraid of this kind of control. And then also, I think white folks being afraid of losing control. And that's been a shift that's been happening. And I think a fear that's been embedded forever, even since, the inception of our quote unquote country or nation, the confluence of these factors and the timing. I think there is kind of an explosion of, you know, we're not going to be controlled. We're not going to be limited. And who is we? I mean, it's lots of different narratives and voices here. But I do think there's a youth generation that's less homophobic, less transphobic, less racist, even if we still internalize all of these narratives. And I think we all do internalize these narratives and stereotypes and whatever models, and these are internal models, but we're starting to become quote unquote conscious, more quote unquote woke, right? As opposed to just holding these unconsciously and taking them as quote unquote truths. And so I think that the collective unconscious assumptions perhaps are being challenged more and brought to the surface to get real group psychoanalytic and what have you. And the way that I think about things as well is also from like a perspective of group psychology beyond the theory of group behavior, you know, unconscious group behaviors and how groups can really be immensely powerful and healing and mobilizing for positive things, but can also be really dangerous in the way that if scapegoats are picked out, you can really destroy and tear people down and destroy folks. So that's a way I think about that on kind of a micro level in the group work that I think Raphael and I study and practice and are mm-hmm. interested in. And within the context of hip hop and outside of it, how groups can be phenomenally powerful from a neurophysiological perspective, from a psychological, social perspective. So I just also think about group unconscious behavior and the way that we interpret stuff. So this is getting very esoteric and abstract. But to come back to it, you can see how these kinds of things play out. The anxieties, the wishes, potential for mobilization, etc., through group behaviors and through what we're seeing now. So that's just my little esoteric abstract kind of insert there.
I just want to add one piece off of there and Elliot's underscoring of groups and my motto is community. That is the last piece about like why now is different. This goes in kind of life course stuff as well. There's been some very significant policy efforts that have come out in a very short period of time, things that people would never even have thought about in a really, we're talking days and weeks, policy efforts that would take forever. And policy change, structural change, that like that's real. Those are real things. And obviously they can be overturned quickly, but that's what we're talking about, structural changes, like a concrete policy change that if this is enacted, populations will be treated differently because this is the policy. And that's enormously promising. People ask, you know, like, why are you doing this? What is the impact? Because those are the policies that serve to exploit. historically, mm-hmm. right? So if we can begin to enact policies that bring equity, you know, those are the structures that change, whether it's in an organization or whether it's, you know, kind of national or federal. And we're seeing little scratches of the surface. And that's encouraging. That's really encouraging. Mm-hmm. It's more than what somebody says. It's like, no, we need to see a different policy and law around, different procedure around how we handle business. So it's not business as usual. That's pretty encouraging.
Yeah, policy changing as well as bodies changing, right? Like, it's like we can feel, one of you guys said that earlier, is that you can feel substantially this. I think it was you, Raphael, saying, okay, you know, like I can remember my first response when I said defund police, right? I feel completely different at this moment from when I very first saw that sign to what I see it now. Like, I can feel my own transition while I was part of it out there and seeing that, like, okay, well, I'm about the institutional, I'm about reform, I'm about, right? But it was the defund, that shifting in my body has been super humbling, and I have a much deeper understanding of what you guys were speaking about earlier about really altering the way we look at authority, the idea that we need a fear-based, militaristic type authority to keep us under control, especially the Black brown populations, you know, rather than, as we started off, the idea of where, Raphael, you mentioned that youth growth is about, doesn't have to be just from an individual, it's from a feeling of being part of a community. And if your community doesn't welcome you and sees you as unsafe and threatening and in a derogatory way, you know, at what point do you get to feel enlivened and part of it? And so the idea, again, I guess I'm doing my own rambling in this, just kind of putting this all together, but like the idea now, defund police seems very, like, in fact, I saw something about Austin taking back millions of dollars from the police force. If you'd have shown me that a year ago, I might have actually felt anxiety about it. You know, like, I'm like, oh my gosh, so what does that mean as a woman? It's like, and yet I really can tell you my transition was, yes, like now that I have a more deeply felt understanding. And I think because I'm listening more, I'm listening. And yeah. I think the persistent voices out there that they haven't stopped and they keep growing and they become more and more articulate, or actually they're probably not more articulate, we're just listening more. So I do share that excitement. It's good to hear that from both of you guys. I mean, obviously we're not there. These are small policy changes, but you can feel the changes in the body, the changes in that we're not okay with this approach anymore. We shouldn't be. And we need to open our ears.
Rafa, I don't know if you're going to say something, but I was just thinking about, like, our attachment system. How has our amygdala been programmed on a greater social level when we're told, you know, like, Black people are dangerous, or, you know, the even the word super predator. I mean, it's such a gross mischaracterization, and it's just a really vulgar way to label a group of people. Again, it's a shifting of the narrative, one which clearly affects people's amygdalas and their attachment systems, or takes us out of this social connection level down to our fight, flight, fear, paranoia, resorting to worst case scenario, hippocampus, amygdala, I was scared, I am scared, I've been programmed to be scared. And even maybe, speaking of inaction and silence is complicity, a freeze or faint, a shutting down. And I think we can use this at a metaphorical level as well as concretely to think about kind of even group. If we look at the United States, or if we look at our communities as an organism, shutting down. And I think that this does happen on macro levels. Again, I'm getting kind of psychoanalytic, but I think if you look at group dynamics, I think it does happen. And it does affect people, the way that we characterize, speak about. Language is very powerful and affects our body. And the way that we use language, the way that all of this kind of thing. And I think that then, if we look at language and cadences and rhythms as being powerful and being used to manipulate or to empower, it can do either. And this is where I'm talking about, like, in the group perspective, then we can circle back to hip hop and say, like, how and why hip hop is so powerful in its use of rhythms, community, communal engagement, communal syncing, coming together, right? And like regulation from the individual, you know, regulating stress response and helping people to cope with stressful and traumatic situations, mobilizing folks, right? And creating potential for action and to not be complicit, and also to regulate oneself and cope with trauma. That's where it, you know, it really came from. It came out of young Black and brown marginalized population that was exposed to extreme trauma in their current situation in, you know, the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s, not to mention the intergenerational trauma, you know, post-slavery, post-reconstruction, those kinds of things. And so that's one of the ways that I understand it and that I think about, you know, like the therapeutic beat-making model that we'll talk about later, hip-hop therapy, therapeutic applications of hip-hop.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope this episode brings you insights, things to contemplate. And again, refer to our show notes. We will have a lot of resources in our show notes, specifically information that Dr. Travis and Dr. Gann mentioned, as well as the resources we mentioned in our intro that could really help enliven this discussion inside yourself between individuals and others. So thank you so much for joining, and tune into our next episode where Dr. Travis and Dr. Gann really dive deeper into the use of hip hop and beat making in order to promote healing of trauma, strategies of empowerment in dealing with depression and anxiety in our youth. And these individuals use these programs throughout the United States and internationally in a quite effective way that has research to it too. So tune into that episode. I think you'll really enjoy it. Anyway, thanks for joining us today. If you found this useful, please pass it on, rate, and review. We would really appreciate. Thank you so much, and we'll see you around the bend.
Therapist Uncensored is Ann Kelly and Sue Marriott. This podcast is edited by Jack Anderson.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.